Well, hello, everyone. This is Steve Miller in Washington. Thank you so much for joining me on VOA's Asia Weekly podcast for July 8th. Now, coming up in this episode, it has been a long, drawn-out affair, but the Permanent Court of Arbitration in The Hague has set aside Tuesday, July 12th, as the date it will announce its decision on the Philippine case against China. Well, what could we see? Plus, Apple continues to lose trademark cases in China. Shanghai Disney's rival amusement park uses stormtroopers to lure in customers. Why do companies continue doing business in China when their intellectual property is often pilfered? But first up, deadly attacks in Bangladesh follow a government sweep of 12,000 people. Do authorities have a handle on a problem that has now claimed victims from around the globe? The Muslim holy month of Ramadan has come to a close, and normally it is a joyous time, marked by the Eid al-Fitr celebrations. Now, at least five attackers targeted a police post in Kishoreganj. Now, this is about 140 kilometers from Dhaka, as hundreds of thousands of people were gathering at a festival there. One police officer was killed in the bomb blast, another was stabbed, and at least one other person, a woman, was killed. Reports indicate that more than a dozen were wounded as well. Authorities say that two of the attackers were killed and a third was captured. Officials haven't linked the assailants to any particular organization, but the Islamic State group had released a video earlier claiming that there would be more violence in Bangladesh. Now, this attack comes about a week after gunmen entered the Holy Artisan Bakery in Dhaka, where more than 30 people were taken hostage. Bangladeshi security forces raided that restaurant, killing six of the attackers and capturing one alive. The perpetrators in that attack killed 20 of the hostages, including citizens from Italy, Japan, and the United States. The deaths were gruesome, with many being hacked to death. The bakery attack also came a day after a Hindu priest was hacked to death and about a fortnight after authorities rounded up 12,000 suspected criminals. Now, while the Islamic State claimed responsibility for the bakery attack, Bangladesh's home minister told the AFP that the attackers were actually members of the Jamaatul Mujahideen Bangladesh, or JMB, a domestic group that's been banned for more than 10 years. The home minister said there was no connection to IS. But who were these attackers? According to an AP report, some of the men who carried out the bakery attack had been missing for months, something that actually did alarm their families. The men also appear to have come from privileged backgrounds and had grown up loved and were educated in top schools. Imtiaz Khan Babul is an official with Bangladesh's ruling Awami League party. Now, his son was actually one of the aggressors in the bakery attack, and Babul appears to have had no idea that his child had been radicalized. So, does the government have a handle on things, and is it doing enough to keep the streets safe? Mustafa Sawar Faruqi is a filmmaker in Bangladesh, and he shared his opinion with VOA.
Bangladesh has never been ready for this kind of military attack, but we don't know how to combat it.
Now, that's the opinion of one civilian. For an expert's analysis on what and why things happened, I spoke to Christine Fair, who studies South Asian political military affairs and is an associate professor at Georgetown University in Washington. She says that even though authorities rounded up over 10,000 people in an effort to curb violence,
the government is much more interested in breaking the backs of the BNP, which is the primary rival party, and their partner, Jamaat Islami. So the Sheikh Hasina government has been very sensitive to any kind of criticisms that her efforts to smash the back of Jamaat have had these negative effects of, for example, prompting the kinds of attacks that you discussed.
Fair says Sheikh Hasina, the prime minister, was facing criticism from the international community for waving aside the notion that Islamic State or other groups were making inroads into the country. She was also under pressure for
essentially stifling freedom of speech. She had really been aggressive and cracking down on the media that was critical of her and what she was doing. So speaking to that, 11,000 is the number that I saw, the 11,000 persons that were rounded up, one of the immediate criticisms was that they're basically BNP party workers as opposed to people that are involved in terrorism.
That point is something that wasn't lost on Faruqi.
When they decide to, you know, run an operation to arrest the Islamic militants, then we think that, okay, it's right. But when they end up arresting 12,000 opposition workers or supporters, then, you know, the question comes, I mean, because they are not the Islamic militants.
Now, making the same point, Fair raises the question of what may have motivated Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina's actions.
She really interested in taking on this terrorism menace, or is she interested in continuing to prosecute a policy to eliminate all of her political foes?
Georgetown University's Christine Fair says that while there is some sectarian violence like that in Pakistan, what's different about the Bangladesh attacks
is that these groups are going after liberal activists, people who are dedicated to undermining the kind of vision that these Islamists themselves want. It is really quite different from the kinds of violence that we've seen elsewhere in South Asia. And I think that what it speaks to is that Bangladesh is, I think it's often referred to too slippery as a successful secular Muslim democracy.
Fair notes that the concept of a secular democracy in Bangladesh has been severely tested since just about the country's inception following independence in 1971. She says there really hasn't been a discussion as to the role of Islam in the state. Fair's research suggests Sheikh Hasina underestimates the strength of the Islamic Party.
Support for Jamaat Islami is actually really high in Bangladesh. And so her approach of basically trying to eviscerate a party that has considerable support suggests that she's kind of out of touch. And not only that, the idea that everyone that's a Jamaat member is involved in terrorism or is a culprit in war crimes is also quite absurd. So, you know, she's put herself in a situation where, by she, I'm talking about the Prime Minister, Sheikh Hasina, she's put herself in a situation where ordinary pious Muslims that want a different kind of state really don't have a political channel through which they can act. And, you know, this does give fear that she's actually providing an incentive for some of these violent entrepreneurs to do what they've done.
So where does Bangladesh go from here?
How does one go from there? Well, I think the answer is not an easy one, but these things don't have easy answers. I think what Bangladesh fundamentally suffers from is that the two parties, the Awami League and the BNP, they have two different narratives of what the nation is. The BNP is more right of center. It acknowledges the place of Islam in politics, and the Awami League undermines that. And the country, very much like the United States, is evenly divided. In other words, the country itself is torn between these candidates. So I think when you've got a country that is so ideologically divided, the roles of political parties are actually more important than anything to try to bring about a national consensus. And yet the two parties themselves are very dysfunctional. There's not really an easy solution to this because the conditions that have given rise to this have been long in the making, and also point out that terrorism in Bangladesh is nothing new.
Fair says that because the police and judiciary are highly politicized, it puts Bangladesh in a poor position to manage the escalating terrorist attacks. The government could turn to outside help, but when assistance has been provided from countries like the United States in the past, the results have been mixed. And that doesn't even get to a larger issue that Fair brings up, which is crime scene mismanagement. So even if help was provided, the evidence authorities may be seeking may no longer be there. But all that being said...
Well, after this Holy Artisan Bakery incident, Dhaka will not remain the same. That's for sure. But we'll fight. We'll fight it out. We'll go to the cafe. We'll go to the workstation. We'll go everywhere. We'll live our life normally. And that's how we'll defeat this militant group who wanted to spread fear in us.
Back in 2013, the Philippines took China to the Permanent Court of Arbitration in The Hague over Beijing's land reclamation activities and claims in the South China Sea. China has always rejected the proceedings, saying the court had no jurisdiction to rule on what it calls its sovereign territory and where it has been conducting military exercises. John Blaxland, senior fellow at the Australian National University Strategic and Defense Studies Center, says the timing of China's actions is not coincidental.
The fact that the military exercise is planned to be completed the day before the ruling, the fact that the Chinese press has come out particularly stridently and frequently in the last few days, being very critical of the Permanent Court of Arbitration, denouncing its standing, claiming it has no legitimacy to rule on the South China Sea, and this all portends significant challenges ahead.
Beijing maintains that the best way to settle the dispute is through bilateral talks, something that newly elected Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte has hinted may be possible, depending on the outcome of the court ruling, which is something we'll know for sure on Tuesday, July 12th. Analysts in general agree that the court is likely to rule in the Philippines' favor and, based on past statements by China, will let the court's decision pass in one ear and out the other, and simply do what it wants, which raises the question, what exactly will Beijing do? Henry J. Kazianis is a senior fellow for defense policy at the Center for the National Interest. In his opinion, there are three ways China could respond to the ruling.
The first one that I looked at, Steve, was basically that China doesn't do more than what it already is doing, which is already quite a bit. As we've seen, the Chinese are militarizing all these fake islands that they've built up over the last 2 years in the South China Sea. And what simply they could do is they could just militarize them even more. I mean, for example, they could add, you know, anti-ship ballistic missiles or the so-called carrier killer that everybody likes to write about, and that's all over the blogosphere. They could add a lot more anti-air assets. They've just purchased from the Russians the S-400 air defense system, very, very, very potent anti-air weapon system, so they could place that there. They could put advanced radar systems that could capture the flight patterns of stealth radars, stealth fighters. So that's something they could do. They could put base submarines and aircraft carriers in those islands. So there's a lot they can do that's already part of that narrative, which is basically militarizing these islands even more and continue to change the status quo.
Kazianis says that this is probably the least likely option because he feels that Chinese leaders, and for that matter the public, will want to respond more forcefully if the decision goes against them.
Option two is that China declares an air defense identification zone. And I think this is actually very, very likely. We've seen this telegraph from Beijing probably for the last couple months and years even. There's been rumors about this for a long time. I mean, basically what China has done in the South China Sea, building out these islands and essentially militarized them, actually sets the stage to do this. Now, the question is, how effective would this be? There's a lot of rumors and talk from different military officials in the Pentagon that I've spoken to and others is that the East China Sea air identification zone is not that potent and not that powerful in terms of a military deterrent. The South China Sea is actually a much bigger area to do this in. So whether the Chinese would be able to do this is an open question, but just the act of declaring it in going this far would be a game changer.
He feels that this is probably the most likely option should the Court of Arbitration rule strongly in the Philippines' favor. Kazianis also says that with the United States having moved additional assets into the area, Washington is poised to challenge the declaration. And that third option?
This is the going rogue option, if you will. And this has been telegraphed a little bit as well. So the Chinese have been sort of setting the stage that this is a possibility. The Chinese have a lot of different options in terms of how they would respond to a ruling. I mean, there are lots of different pressure points that Xi Jinping could actually press if he felt the need. One is in the East China Sea. So we're seeing this ratcheting up of tensions by China, but also it filters down into Taiwan, where there are tensions once again between Beijing in Taipei. And then we also have all the different things that the Chinese can do in the South China Sea. So Beijing has a lot of different ways to respond to this, and they really are in a position to dictate how far they want to go and how far they want to push. But what's very, very troubling is a pattern of statements that have come out recently. Xi Jinping said on Friday, apparently, that we're not afraid of trouble when it comes to the South China Sea. And this has been a theme that different Chinese generals and admirals have been saying really for the last month or two.
Harry Kazianis also says that newly elected Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte is a bit of an X factor in all of this because he's opened up a way that could actually de-escalate the tension. Now, how likely is this? Well, that remains to be seen. as President Duterte has said that while he isn't married to the Aquino administration's policy, he does wish to see fruitful development of the South China Sea. Duterte has also declared that whatever he decides will be in the best interest of his nation. But Beijing has said it will only talk with Manila if the Philippines disregards the court's ruling. But what is the best path forward if China won't even acknowledge the court's decision and jurisdiction?
I think that's the $5 trillion question, referring to the amount of trade that basically goes through the South China Sea. You know, what do you do with a rising power that believes that it's basically been historically wronged and feels that it has the privy and now capabilities to control this vast sea and region? I think really the only thing that you can do is you need to put up roadblocks in front of Beijing. And that's really for the United States to do, and to come out forcefully and say, look, You are not going to put borders around a sea, a common space in the ocean. The ramifications are going to be stark throughout the world. I mean, you look at what Russia's doing in a lot of parts of the world. You look at other countries like Iran. We have to be concerned that this will become a norm and codified basically in international law, and other countries will act the same way.
One roadblock that Kazianis says that could be put up would be to detail the environmental damage done to the South China Sea as Beijing continues to build artificial islands. In essence, trying to shame China into stopping their actions by exposing the harm they're doing to the environment. And in what may be a preview of what's to come, China and Japan squared off in the skies above the East China Sea. China says two Japanese fighters took what it calls provocative actions, lining up a pair of Chinese fighters with fire control radar. In a statement, China's defense ministry says the Japanese plane's provocative actions caused an accident in the air, endangering the safety of personnel on both sides and destroying the peace and stability in the region. Japan has acknowledged that something took place, but denies that radar lock was used or the incident was dangerous. Whatever the court's judgment in the case, its implications won't be known immediately, or even perhaps for some time. Harold Ching, a university student in Manila, says,
"This case will surely affect our lives, especially the next generation."
Duterte has said that the Philippines remains optimistic that the tribunal will rule in their favor, adding that if the ruling were to go against the Philippines, he would accept it and abide by it. If Duterte does choose to open a dialogue with President Xi, college student Mara Nang in Manila notes,
"Usually the stronger and powerful party will dictate the terms and conditions, and we all know that we are not that powerful enough."
If you're in the United States, one of the preeminent sporting apparel brands is Under Armour. You can see their logo on Major League Baseball and American National Football League team uniforms. But if you're in China, you'll see something that looks like the Under Armour logo, but not quite. Uncle Martian is a sporting apparel manufacturer in China that turned a few heads when it launched and aims to do the exact same thing as its American counterpart. Unless you've been under a rock for the better part of the last decade, you've of course heard of the iPhone, Apple's flagship communication device. The phones are known for their sleek designs and simple interface. But in China, where Apple is a relative newcomer to the marketplace, Xiaomi's MIUI 6 operating system, which is based on Google's Android platform, has been tweaked to appear just like Apple iOS's. And, of course, Disney has made headlines when it opened its latest theme park in Shanghai. And while you can go there and see a wide range of Disney characters, well, it's not the only place you can do so. Locals and tourists alike can go to the Wanta Cultural Tourism City and get their fill of Disney characters as well, even though they haven't been licensed there. What's with all the copyright infringement and intellectual property theft? The Milken Institute's Asia fellow, Curtis S. Chin, spoke to me via Skype.
Intellectual property rights violations are par for the course in China. And any company going in, whether American, European, or even Asian, knows that's part of the challenge of doing business in China today. And some of the recent examples, I'd say, are kind of astounding.
He says that even with all of these flimsy and even outlandish excuses, companies pretty much expect this because
China is not known for a rule of law. When it comes to business, corruption is endemic. That's what Transparency International out of Europe will say. When you look at the business climate, the regulatory climate, again, China is in many ways an unwelcoming environment. But why do people still go in? And the reality is that it's such a big market. And so that's what companies are trying to balance out. Despite all these problems and difficulties, maybe endless lawsuits that generally rule against a foreign company, despite all this, will they be able to make money in China? I think that's really the bottom line.
Chin says that companies factor in the cost of litigation and the theft of intellectual property when making the decision to do business in China. However, he does expect that at some point in the future, that will no longer be the case. But the Milken Institute's Curtis S. Chin brought up the American Chamber of Commerce's most recent survey regarding doing business in China.
77% of those companies feel that they are much less welcome today in China than that they were a year ago. And some 57% of these companies that responded to this American Chamber of Commerce survey said that they're facing inconsistent regulations, murky laws, rising anti-foreign sentiment, all leading to not so great a business environment. Yet despite all of these concerns, you know, all of these terrible things, that survey also said that 68% of those companies responding were still going to continue to invest in China. 32% said that they have no more plans to invest anymore in China, which was like the highest percentage in some times with that annual survey. But again, it underscores that balance, that tension between the tremendous challenges in China and the opportunity that exists in China just because of that, of the size of that growing middle class, that growing consumer class in China.
And one final note on my way out the door. The United States has placed North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and 10 other officials on a blacklist for human rights abuses. Human Rights Watch's Deputy Asia Director Phil Robertson says it's an important step forward in achieving justice for the countless victims of human rights abuses in North Korea. Robertson also says that the United States should undertake more research and expand this list further. And you know what? That's going to do it for me this week. But don't forget, the conversation does not end here. Please hit me up on Facebook. Hit me up on Twitter. Just look for Steve Miller VOA and let me know your thoughts and opinions. And also be sure to join our community Facebook page, VOA Now. To get the podcast delivered to you automatically, be sure to subscribe in iTunes or your favorite podcast application. It's quick, it's easy, and best of all, absolutely free. Well, my friends, thank you so much for joining me this week. In Washington, I'm Steve Miller. And until next time, be true to yourself and always be awesome.